Hello and welcome back to Community, the EcoVillage podcast from Gen Europe. How can a localized economy circulate money within the community? Can local economies support livelihoods, build resilience and foster community? Today, we are thrilled to bring you a recording of Anja Lundbeck's keynote speech and workshop from the annual European EcoVillage gathering held in Engsbacka in 2024. In this inspiring session, Anja Lundbeck, localization activist and programs director of The Local Futures, shares her journey through the heart of local economies, drawing from her experiences living in Oaxaca, Mexico, where community-centered trade thrives in markets filled with fresh produce, handmade goods, and local services. Join us now and dive into Anja's riveting keynote address as she calls on us all to envision a future rooted in localization. And as we listen, let's ask ourselves, what steps would you take in service to the earth if you knew you couldn't fail?
I'm really happy to be here with so many people engaged in creating healthy, beautiful communities from around the world. I also just want to say to Engsbacka, very sorry for your loss. And thank you for letting us be here and letting me be here in this beautiful place. So I'm going to be talking about economic localization, which is a route to local living economies that are rooted in place. This is about going back to a human scale, like we have been for most of the evolution in human history, where we have lived within ecological limits, learned to live in vastly different ecosystems, developed huge diversity, and above all, collaboration and care for each other and for the land. So this is kind of what economic localization is about. It's not about going back to the past, but it's about not going further down the road that we are on at the moment. It's also about slowing down being rooted in place, which is kind of the opposite of our society on today, on steroids that makes us run faster and faster. Many, just to keep a roof over our heads, and others because that is just what we are caught up in. My little contribution here will be divided into three parts because we've got a few interventions. So the first one, which will be about taking stock of the dominant system. The second part will be about shifting direction and the power of local. And the third part will be about grassroots movements and taking action to build, move towards a critical mass of people. So I'll start by doing a bit of a bird's eye view or X-ray of the dominant system. So I'm simplifying things, but it's to allow us to see some patterns that can help us change things. Number one, we're talking about a corporate-led global economy. And whoever we are, wherever we are to a varying degrees caught up in that, even when we are trying to create alternatives. No? So we are kind of, many of us living in this perhaps parallel world, but we are very much caught up in it. It's an economy that is basically anti-life, and it's come to dominate everything. It's not like in the past where the economy was like the, you know, like the Greek term of the management of the household. It is now what determines most political decisions, our social life, and sadly also what's going on planet Earth, no? And from the very beginning of our lives, we are sort of groomed to consume, prepared to consume from childhood. Advertising, as you know, geared towards younger and younger people from the very birth to our deaths. And we are groomed to consume to grow the economy. And it robs us of our identities, erodes our identities. a person that has a strong identity, self-worth, feel they are beautiful as they are not a very good consumer. No. You have to feel pretty shitty about yourself so that they can sell you lots of products through our lives so that we can be happy. And that's a roller coaster that is growing year by year. If you look at the marketing expenditure, for example, with just that money, we could all shift to renewable energy, we could eradicate extreme poverty. So it's quite serious. It's also leading to, as I'm sure many of you know from your own experience, to monoculture. Monoculture of the land, loss of biodiversity, huge industrial scale agriculture, but also monoculture of human culture. No? Loss of connection with land, loss of languages. When you lose languages, you lose knowledge, you lose practices that has enabled us to coexist in our environments. And when you lose all that, it's like we like newborn babies in many senses, because we can't express, we don't have the knowledge, no? For example, to heal our land. So and the monoculture of the mind that is coming through mainstream media, very much corporate-led media, is also leading us along the line of thinking that what we're living in is almost evolutionary, no? And I'm very sad that we have to mention growth, because I can't believe that after decades of criticism and realizing that we are living on a finite earth and we can't have infinite growth, we still have to talk about it. And I'm sure most of us here probably have a critical attitude to growth, realizing that we can't just, like cancer, continue to grow as measured by GDP, which is in modern society how we measure progress, infinitely. No? But that is still what is peddled in mainstream society. And both, you know, along a very broad spectrum of the political spectrum from the left to the right, there is still not the much question of growth. There was more a question about growth and criticism in the 80s and the 90s than we read now. It's like it's been taken for granted. And of course, you all have heard that, you know, growth is presented as the solution. You know, if we don't grow the economy, we can't afford to solve our social problems or our environmental problems. We're going to be left behind. And we're all going to be better off through this trickle-down effect, where the big companies and the rich, you know, will let some of that wealth trigger down to the bottom. Well, it's more like a machine that sucks up. As you will know, that we now, what we talk about, an economy for the 1%, the super rich, at the expense of planet Earth and the majority of the world's population. And what is it that makes our economy grow? Well, it's mainly negative things. Things like, you know, if our water is polluted and we all have to buy bottled water, that's very good for growth. Or if our populations are ill and we have to buy a lot of medication, that's also very good for growth. If we're all healthy, that's not particularly good for growth, because it doesn't create a rise in GDP. And we just had a case in Denmark, and you might have heard of it, but the Danish economy is doing very well because we got a huge pharmaceutical that's called Novo Nordisk, and they've made this fantastic medicine that can help you lose weight. And there's a huge demand, and that is in response to a global economic system and industrial agriculture that have people malnourished, so that a lot of people are suffering from obesity and diabetes. But now we have a drug, so the Danish economy is doing very well. And of course, when we have war and conflict, there are lots of sales of arms, and that also grows the economy. But if we plant some trees, we clean our water, we make a compost toilet instead of having sewage, if we care for our children or for our neighbors, that is not growing the economy. It's not progress as we measure it today. Another thing about this global economy, keep time. You're keeping time on me, right, Natasha? Yeah, great. Is that we've got what I call a phantom economy, a ghost economy. It's a debt economy. It's not tied to anything real. They are digits on a computer screen. Money is created when someone asks for a loan, be it you or me, or the Swedish state, or Microsoft, or Shell, right? That's how money is created in that moment. It's mere digits. So it's not tied to anything real, and it's totally unlimited. And we got a sense of that, well, a real sense, in 2008 with the financial crisis, which was called the bubble, you know, that where they had, lent a lot of money to people, no backing. And who bailed out the banks? The nation states did, with taxpayers' money. And that's just one example of how money and power is shifted from nation states to private corporations. I think the only country to jail some of these people and make consequences for the banks was Iceland. And I just want to go a little bit back to show that this kind of debt economy, that's not new. I don't know if you've ever heard of fractional reserve banking. It goes a long way back to the time of colonization. So when in the 15th century, the Europeans went abroad to colonize and pillage and rape and enslave people, that was enabled in large part due to fractional reserve banking. Private lenders, and you know, at the time, the banks of their time were allowed to issue credits 10 times their reserve. So if they had, 1,000 gold coins, they could issue 10,000 gold coin credits. And that enabled a lot of the sending abroad and colonizing. And I'm using that example, and of course it was paid back many times with what was robbed and extracted from other areas. Other countries, other regions. But this is what's enabling this destructive economy today as well. Because the money has no limit, no backing, anyone with a good idea can borrow money to do fracking, to do deep sea mining, to fell our forests, and what have you. It's as long as they can pay it back. And in our society, you can pay it back because we are robbing Earth's resources like as if we were emptying our own bank account in a minute. No? So this debt economy is fueling destruction. And of course, with digitalization and high tech, it's happening at a much faster and bigger scale than ever before. And I also, we've also had a process, and particularly those of us that are older will know, of neoliberalization, where a lot of common goods have been privatized, from infrastructure to services to trains to, our energy infrastructure, what have you, and sold to foreign investors, big companies, and they end up in the stock market. And on the stock market, as we know, is pretty much ruled by algorithms. You got from individuals, but usually huge investments funds, pension funds, that are selling life. Everything has been commodified. Even things for our basic needs, foods, services, there are forests or extraction of forests and so forth. So all that trading that's going on and speculating and betting is affecting people all around the world. Small-scale farmers, when the price of coffee or corn or oranges are low, can mean that they lose their livelihoods. And it's driving marginalization and migration because people are losing their livelihoods. So, you know, this is a lot, perhaps, to think about. And often, I think we feel it's like an unstoppable force. It's so big that we turn our face away or draw inwards because we can't cope with it. But it helps, at least for me, to know that this is man-made. It's entirely man-made. It didn't happen by itself, and it can be remade. And there are certain mechanisms that are sort of instrumental in maintaining this system that we have to be aware about. They are like acupuncture pressure points that we have to denounce, that we have to pressure, and that we can use to change things to shift in the other direction. And the three sort of main thing is the free trade treaties, as in free for the corporations, not free for nation states, subsidies and taxes. And they have been used, these mechanisms, and particularly the free trade treaties, to deregulate private corporations and basically having them on what I call corporate welfare. And so there are a myriad of bilateral, multilateral free trade treaties that nations around the world have signed on to, many of them for good reason, thinking that, you know, we need international trade as a part of cooperation and collaboration. But what is really meant is that you have these, what? All right, that was what I was saying. I always speak more than I should. Is leading to a race to the bottom, because businesses can move around with the situation is best for them. It's often a situation of the rule of the lowest denominator moving to where the salary are lowest, where there are no environmental standards, where you might get biggest help, free land, what have you. And you end up in a situation where you have producers from one side of the earth pitted against the other, right? In lowering their prices, lowering their environmental standards, lowering their salaries. And I want to give one example of from Mexico. I don't know if you heard about NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, in the 90s. Well, that opened up the door to subsidize corn from the US. That was far cheaper than the corn that wasn't subsidized, produced by small producers in Mexico. Nearly 5 million farmers had to give up their livelihoods. Many of those migrated to the US and worked as laborers in intensive agriculture, maybe the same ones that put them out of business, who knows. It also opened the door to Walmart, which is this huge chain of supermarkets. It opened the doors to junk food. And now Mexico is number one consumer of fizzy drinks and number one in diabetes in the world. So that's just like an example that I know about personally. And the subsidies that I mentioned, you know, the fossil fuel industry, when I started talking about this, I was saying fossil fuel industry subsidies were half or 500 billion is a year, 1 trillion. Now we're talking about $77 trillion in subsidies to fossil fuel industries in 2022. That was also after COVID, where we started, where we had less global trade. No? And imagine what would have happened if we had dealt and looked at the subsidies, if we had been aware of them. We weren't aware of them 20 years ago, for example. We wouldn't have had a lot of the problems that we have today with contamination, pollution, plastic. If they hadn't been subsidized, a lot of that wouldn't have been a problem today, wouldn't have been a crisis. We might not even have had the climate crisis that we have now. There are a lot of subsidies for export, there are lots of subsidies for the global transport infrastructure, huge ports, all of that usually paid for by nation states, benefited by global corporations. And industrial agriculture get on a global level the equivalent of $1 million per minute. Now, how much of that do you think goes to what we could put under regenerative agriculture? 1%. It is no wonder that industrial food, processed food, is cheaper than the food around the corner. No? It's no wonder, it's actually amazing that we have organic farmers, biodynamic farmers, that we have small-scale farmers, that we've got real regenerative farming under these circumstances. Imagine what the world looked like if we just spent some of that money to support real healthy farming and food, no? So just to summarize, the big and the global are deregulated and subsidized. And the smaller the local, I haven't talked about that, is generally speaking, overregulated and taxed. That is not a level playing field. And the good news is that we can change things. I like to say it's man-made and can be remade. And there have been studies done to show in social non-violent movements from around the world that you need a critical mass of about 3.5% of people actively engaged to create social change. When you have 3.5% actively engaged, you usually have about 20% that repeated, have you heard about, have you read about, you know, what do you think about? And that is enough to create a change. I want you to share an example about a local economy example that I had when I moved to Mexico. I moved to Mexico and lived in the south, in the state of Oaxaca, where I lived with my husband when I first arrived, and his parents. And they had some land and had some cows, a few sheep, fruit trees, what have you. And I loved to observe how every day they would be selling a variety of things. I have to say, it's not like they were self-sufficient or anything. They'd had other jobs or retired, but they were still selling from their farm. And they would be selling firewood, fresh milk from their cows, fresh cheese, surplus fruit, in-season fruit, and sometimes meat. And my mother-in-law has this little wooden chest, and when people would come to the door, she would put the money into that wooden chest. And also to that door would come people that would be selling freshly fresh fish, living close to the ocean, shrimp, tortillas made by hand, tamales, fresh flowers, homemade chocolate for drinking chocolate, a whole host of products. And from that same chest, the money would go out again. And now just observe that every single day, So this is like my mental picture for a local economy, of how the money circulates within the economy to provide meaningful livelihoods for people there, that, of course, has ripple effects all through the economy. It sustains farming, it sustains artisans, and that is the exact opposite of what happens when we are, I'd say, forced to shop, many of us, in big change. The money goes out. It's like a leaking bucket. You know, the big chain, Starbucks, is not going to go around spending their money locally. They're going to take it out and invest it elsewhere, for example. No? And in terms of circulating money locally, as I was just mentioned from Mexico, that's the same thing that happens if we go to a farmer's market, for example. There are studies that show if you go into a farmer's market and buy directly from a farmer or in some other way, the money stays within the local community 10 times longer than if you spent the same money in a chain store. No? Or if you buy from an independent retailer, maybe not even local products, that money is likely to stay 3.5 times longer within your local community. And that means more jobs, that means more schools, it means more taxes, it means more community. So it's something really important to keep in mind also, that localization, at least that's something we are faced with often, is that it's not about going back in time. And it's not about bringing everything down to a village level either. But it is about shifting a direction away from the global. And here I'm thinking particularly these deregulated transnational corporations that have been allowed to have more power, really, than nation states, more wealth. Many of these private companies are wealthier than a single country. So it's shifting power away again from the transnational corporations to nation states while building up regional self-reliance. That is a process of localization. And how can we do that? Well, using the same mechanism, using our taxes, our subsidies and regulations to support the needs of people, of communities, and not big business. We also need, in that process, to re-regulate the banks and business, take back some of that immense freedom to roam and rob, so that they're subject to democratic control and ecological limits. And there's a principle called subsidiarity, which I think is key in localization. It's a principle of social organization, I'm reading here, that maintains the social and political issues should be addressed at the most immediate level consistent with their resolution. So it's more about direct democracy closer to home, taking the decisions closer to where they are having an impact. And the same thing with production. You may know within the local food movements, you often find that local food, well, it's defined in different ways in different places, but vegetables and fruit you might expect to get within a 50 or 100 kilometer range. Grains, you might have to go a bit further away. Oil, a bit further away. When you're talking about industrial products like steel, further away. 10 minutes. Okay, thank you. But it's about producing for our basic needs closer to home. It's totally illogical to be depending for our basic needs on global trade, or to be expecting the people on the other side of the world should sacrifice their best lands to producing for somebody else, no? We all have the right to produce for our basic needs and sell the surplus, maybe to a national market, international market. So localization or shift in direction is a bit like a solution multiplier because it helps us rebuild community, connect to place, reduce our ecological footprints, reduce our dependence on energy, reduce our emissions. And it's, as I said before, easier to see the consequences of our actions. It's easier to be someone that can have a positive impact, right, of healing our lands when you know it, when you're rooted there. And there's so much going on around the world that I want to share about. I've picked out a few, and I must say that I've been working on these issues for many decades, and like 2-3 decades ago, we were in the organization I work for, we're keeping like those like drawers, I can't remember, with the hanging files, and we'd have for all the countries, we'd have, a little leaflet at that time, they were all little printed leaflets, oh, there's this and that, and you know, in this country, there are 3 projects. We would sort of know about a lot of them. Now, it's impossible to keep track. And it's so wonderful because there's so much going on everywhere that we sadly don't get to hear about, which is one of the things that we need to get better at. So there are political changes happening and there are community projects, and I'll just mention a few. I don't know if you heard about community wealth building. That's a way of using public procurement. That means public money to buy goods and services for government institutions. That's a really, really fast way to make change, to strengthen your local economy. You've got some money right there, you've got some consumers right there, quite big ones, and if you can, instead of buying from Amazon or what have you, buy the service and the goods from local producers, you're already strengthening the economy. So Cleveland, Ohio in the US, which is in the Rust Belt, has a population of 360,000. They did just that. They use what they call anchor institutions, which are hospitals, universities, and others, and tried to change their purchasing policy. They combine that with deciding of trying to buy sustainable products and buying from worker cooperatives. So that had, you know, multiple impacts within that economy, quite immediate impacts. Preston, UK, it's a sort of kind of working class community in the north of England, a bit smaller, 150,000, that ended up almost like a boarded up town after the financial crisis in 2008, where a lot of the shops closed. And they have copied the same thing or developed their own model. It's known as the Preston model, where they are also using public procurement, about £1 million every year, that are geared towards buying services that are good from worker cooperatives that are from Preston, generating much needed livelihoods and keeping the money within the community. Another example of public procurement from France, some of you that are from France here may know better. Oh, there we have, yeah. The territorial food projects. And I want to highlight one from, I'm sure I'm going to mispronounce this, Mont-Saint-Trois. Yeah, well, this is a town of 10,000 people. And they set themselves the task of providing food without pesticides in their schools in the town, 1,300 meals a day. Then they figured out, oh, they couldn't guarantee, they couldn't find a way to guarantee that it was pesticide free, so they thought, well, we have to go with pure organic. And they wanted it to be as local as possible. So they're providing 100% organic food in schools, 70% of which is local. They started out by commissioning some farmers to produce organic food and ended up also buying some land that are then now used also as a as a outdoor learning space for the children. No? Another example from Mexico, Tosepan, a big union of cooperatives, of 430 cooperatives, mostly farmers, covering 40,000 members in two states. Their name means United We Will Overcome. They live by or guided by Buen Vivir y Ecnemilis, which is about cooperation and caring for the land. They use agroecology, and they are both renewing and resisting, you could say, because they are facing and have strong opposition to fracking, mining, a lot of the things, and managed to stop Walmart coming in. The local food movement is probably, I think, the movement that is leading the way in the localization. There are so many projects from all over the world, farmers markets, community-supported agriculture, community gardens, consumer co-ops, from Zimbabwe to China to Denmark. A lot of them, I'm short of time, so I can't really mention all. A lot of them, maybe in the workshop. There are a lot of local investment projects as well, where grassroots investment that goes towards lending money to small farmers, to new entrepreneurial projects that are helping to strengthen the local economy. And community land trusts that are managing to hold, to acquire and hold the land for place-based communities, for affordable housing, for shops, for community shops, for community gardens. And of course, there are also some good news on the local decentralized energy scene that I could talk about. But sadly, I think mostly the renewable energy transition has been co-opted by large-scale corporations. And I will say that this has been going on for many years. There have been so much development on alternative energy by, I would say, people from outside the dominant system, and many of them had their businesses bought up and closed down. The lid caped on it until we had our our back against the wall and were sort of forced to accept this is the process we're in. But anyway, we can talk more about that in the workshop, and also about alternative education. Yeah. Yeah.
Hello, there you go. So there's a bit more to come, but now we want to ask you a question. So just hearing everything that Anya was just sharing, and actually about how much is actually going on for making a change in the world, we are inviting you now to turn to a person in the room. So find a partner, ideally somebody you haven't talked to yet. And now, does everyone have a partner? Maybe we put their hands down again. If anybody doesn't have a partner, you can put a hand up and you can find another person with a hand up. Great. right. Now that you all have partners, yes, you will have around 2 minutes each to share with the other person. If you knew that you could not fail, what would you do in service to the earth? I'll repeat that. If you knew that you could not fail, what would you do in service to the earth? And the person with the longest hair starts.
What? Absolutely.
And now you can switch partners. We can switch partners. And come to a close, so you can finish your sentences. And come to a close. We love to hear that you have so much to share. And Anya also has a bit more that she would like to share. So we will hand over the word to Anya again, and then we will come back into this. Thank you.
Yeah, I will just say, in 2020, we was at the height of the COVID. I'm sure a lot of us had a change of plans, and the org. Sorry. All right. Okay, in 2020, my organization, Local Futures, were stranded like everybody else and couldn't do any of the things we had planned. And we were noticing that many of the things that we had talking about for years and that people had been rejecting as being naive or romanticizing the possibilities for change, people were then suddenly realizing, oh, there's some truth. We are very vulnerable when we are relying on our food from far away. Oh, it's great to have good neighbors and strong communities, and it's even more wonderful when somebody produces food around the corner. People realize that. So we decided, okay, we're not going to keep inactive or shut down, so we came up with something called World Localization Day as a way of trying to showcase how much is going on around the world and making that invisible, that it's sort of invisible movement visible. So we came up and we did a day-long program with 100 voices, with people from five continents. And we didn't really have any expectations as to people participating, but we had people tuning in from 191 countries. I think there are only about 250 countries in the world. And just gave us a sense that this is something that matters and that people can recognize the need for everywhere. No? And I also want to say here that it's very common that people turn to what's closest to them and they see the value in a time of crisis. And then we forget about it afterwards when things are normalized. Of course, nothing about our economy is normal, but it seems that when we are in this matrix that that's the norm, right? So this is localization is more than a lifeboat in a time of crisis. It is a lifeboat in a time of crisis, more than anything. But it's also a strategy for long-term change. No? And there are so many movements around the world that I would say are working for systemic change, maybe slightly different ways. And we're not good enough at working together to be seen and as a bigger force. One I want to mention is La Via Campesina. It is the biggest grassroots movement in the world, representing 220 million small-scale farmers, peasant land workers from around the world, and from 81 countries. They stand for food sovereignty. They stand for the small farmers that produce food in diversified ways, within ecological limits. They practice agroecology, and they are the most vocal people on criticizing big agribusiness, GMOs, agrochemicals, and they have very good analysis on WTO and free trade treaties. It's an interesting thing. But in the global south, and particularly with farmers, people are much more aware of those globalizing mechanisms that we are in the West. Because we are not at the forefront, on the bad side. We are not there having some mining company just outside our door or someone felling all our trees or killing the activists. Well, many of us haven't experienced that. No? So that's an organization, that's a movement really to be reckoned with. With that, in Latin America, the agri-ecology movement is very big. I don't think we have it so much in Europe, no? Here we have the permaculture movement, like in Australia, but in Latin America and in Africa, it's the agri-ecology movement, which is also more than, it's organic, but more, there's more land management, and it's also quite politicized. It goes along with a social movement, and they also stand for food sovereignty. Jen, I mean, I haven't talked about Jen because you know more about Jen than I do, but when I go to other places and talk about movement, I always mention Jen. And for me, Jen is like a perfect a seedbed for a new economy, no? That all these eco-villages. I think maybe I'm including my own eco-village. We need to be better at advocating for economic change and maybe sort of be a bit more economic literate. But, you know, where would you go? 5 minutes, okay. So where would you go to get all that knowledge and practices of alternative from eco-technology to growing? And so, above all, I think the organizational, you're learning new governance, new ways of living together, you'd go to the global eco-village movement, no? And transition towns that played a huge and important role in its time. And that we've got movements here, represented here, Ecolis, the European Network for Community-Led Initiatives on Climate Change and Sustainability, and REPES, the International Network for Solidarity Economy. And there are lots of other movements, the degrowth movement, the positive money movement, the organizations that lie like We All, the Wellbeing Alliance, the Economy for the Common Good. All of these are sort of, in one way or another, working for systemic change. Yeah, let's systems, yeah. And there are movements that we probably never heard of, like I'm familiar with something sort of vaguely called the slow living movement in Japan, which is a tendency of young people, very well educated, signed up, maybe they already have a career, that are rejecting that lifestyle and wanting to live a slower, more meaningful life, moving to rural areas, maybe working part-time, to have more time for being together, for playing, for singing, for doing other things, more meaningful things with other people. And in China, there's something known as the rural reconstruction movement. We don't hear a lot about what's going on in China, but there are also things going on there that we are unaware of. And we as Local Futures, when we talk about taking action, what can we do? We have sort of landed on five things that I think that we think can help effective activism and building healthy communities. We call them the five R's. So the first is reconnect, the second is rethink, the third is resist, the fourth is renew, and the fifth is rejoice. I'll talk about that now. Reconnecting is about reconnecting to others and nature. And I think all of you, I'm sure, are doing that beautifully. Many are alone. I mean, certainly in Western culture, we've brought up to thinking independence is the best quality we can have. Not into the dependence, no? So it's about changing the I to a we so that we feel better and so that we can be more effective. And rethinking progress and development, as I mentioned before, how do we measure progress today? What do we see as development? And kind of busting the myth about the global economy, no? And resisting, I talked a bit about that. Many of the communities, as I said, that are the forefront are the ones that are resisting the most because they have got destruction on their doorstep. And that's not right. If we want political change, systemic change, we need to start resisting the global corporate economy. And to building up to that critical mass, and maybe, in my opinion, one of the most important things we can do is to spread the word. I mean, it's kind of educating ourselves and educating others. Renewal on a local level. Well, that's what a lot of us are involved in already, and I think when people aren't really involved, I always say look to local food first, because being part of the local food movement is an easy way, an easy step in, and can have big consequences. We all need food every day, three times a day, and it's something that can be very powerful and that can make where we can see change very quickly. And the big picture activism there with the resist and renew of making the invisible visible, and that the two sides of the coins, unmasking the global economy and showing and showcasing what's already going on. Because a lot of people that haven't had any experience with alternatives, they are stuck in their mind with the vision presented to us by marketing, which is usually very high tech and, you know, totally divorced from life, or the futuristic dystopian visions that you see in science fiction films. I mean, I talk to a lot of people, and particularly the young, that's what they're stuck with. Oh, well, we can't do anything about it because we're going to end up out there, sort of somewhere between Mad Max and some other film, no? And then there's the fifth one, rejoice. We need to celebrate life and all the beauty that is still with us, and also remember to celebrate our small victories, our steps on the way. We get so caught up, all of us, in making change, and we forget to say, "Hey, we did something." We have to sort of realize that we are in the middle of a huge process of transformation. And Ida was mentioning something about, I think it was a dying system, which maybe not exact that, those words, but I think we are witnessing a dying system, even though we think of it as the norm, as status quo. A bit like the Roman Empire that throws the biggest parties at the very end, no? On that note, on the rejoicing note, I think I'll end.
Thank you for tuning into Community, the January podcast. This episode was brought to you by the Communities for Local Green Deals project. This EU-funded initiative is a partnership of the following organizations: Ecolis, Econ, ILARD, ICLEI, and CEI ISCTE. This project is dedicated to tackling the climate and environmental crisis while addressing social and political divides across Europe. To learn more, follow Communities for Local Green Deals on social media.